This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. My name is Arman Zildiz, and this is New Books Network. I had the great pleasure of hosting Jennifer Evans today, and we'll talk about their book, The Queer Art of History, Queer Kinship After Fascism, which came out of Duke University Press in 2023. Welcome to the New Books Network, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us and writing this wonderful book. Before we talk about the book, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a professor of history at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. I have taught here for a long time now, and I have the great pleasure of having amazing students who come to work with me on queer and trans history. And I also have this other hat that I wear sometimes that is interested in the current moment, the populist threat and the authoritarian turn. So sometimes that is useful in framing sort of my way into some of these subjects.
And I mean, although this is a history book, it also comes out like your concern with the contemporary. It really comes through in a wonderful way. And how did this book come about? What's the story behind it?
It's an interesting story. It's a funny book. I mean, it's a second book, right? It's a second monograph. And I didn't have the intention of writing it as a standalone book. I published ideas over the last, probably over the last 10 years, and developed certain themes that were interesting to me that came out of projects I was working on photography or on sexual regulation. And in a way, they were patchwork. They went in this direction and that direction. And then at one point, I thought to myself, I wonder if actually some of this kind of works together and actually is part of a singular story. And once the light went off in my head that in fact I was in a way workshopping ideas these last years, then I could see a book. And the trick was, you know, what glues it all together? And this is where I realized that I was actually trying to tell the story of interlocking and intersecting dramas, and that kinship was the glue that you know bound it all together. So it's a funny, it's not your typical story. And what was interesting is that when I realized that, or I thought I realized I had something, it was then a question of what do you do with it? You know, is this in fact a book that a publisher might want to publish? And where would that be? And I'd had a lot of inquiries over the course of the last years from publishers who knew a little bit about my work and were curious, you know, are you writing a book about Herbert Tobias, this photographer that you published on in the HR? Are you writing a book about you know, rent boys. And I'd always said, no, 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 I'm not. And then finally, I realized, oh, well, maybe somebody might be interested. So I first went to a publisher and floated the boat. And this was, at Princeton University Press. And I talked to Priya there and I said, here are my ideas. What do you think? And she said, I love them, but not for our press. But I think you should try Duke. Mm. And that's how I ended up approaching Duke with the idea. And they were very keen and they saw in this, you know, project something that they could get behind. So it's and winding road.
But that's also a very generous way of engaging with your monograph, like from Princeton University Press. I mean, it's also like really like the way you're talking about queer kinship that it kind of materialized in these relationships, it seems. And which brings me to my second question, like, what is queer kinship and why is it important?
It is very much about kinship, right? It's about the conversation I had with that editor was the product of years in the making of checking in once in a while in emails, of following each other's career paths. And, you know, so for me, kinship, and, you know, it's an intellectual category, so it has its moorings in conversations that have been taking place for years now in other places and spaces, in Black feminism, in queer of color, trans of color critique. But for me, it's this really interesting thing that allows us to sort of almost enunciate sort of that special something that connects us sometimes intellectually, emotionally, libidinally, and that we can't always articulate, but it's that thing that brings some of us into each other's orbits and that creates something of knowing, of an affinity, of solidarity. And so my job was to use history to try to explain that special something that puts us in conversation and in relations with people across our differences, because I felt that from where I stood looking at history of sexuality, we were becoming really siloed in the way that we were practicing or doing our work. And I wanted a method and a category that would allow us to gather across all of our differences. And I think kinship can do that. And it does that for all sorts of reasons, right? The idea of everything from kinship as found family, kinship as alliances, kinship as solidarities. And so I really liked the fact that it was a very workable category. And I wanted to try to give it some substance in the book by using historical examples.
I mean, and in the book, you also refer to bad kin and good kin and how this is not like, just because it's kinship, it doesn't mean that we sit comfortably with these relationships. Can you tell us more about that and maybe like speak of some of the examples you have from the book?
Sure. Yeah, and I really benefited from thinking about good and bad kin through one of the conversations I had with a colleague here at Carleton, Alexis Shotwell, who is a philosopher trained at Santa Cruz, who works also on kinship. And so she was essential to my thinking. But it really is this idea that at least in thinking about Germany and thinking about the post-45 period, East and West Germany, that there are multiple examples of places where people come together and work in solidarity for a common cause. And then there are times when certain people and their politics or their way of being in the world doesn't quite fit with the decisions of a group of people organizing for change. And so I was really interested in those moments when some people were seen as maybe casualties or negatively affecting the group's motives for change. And so one of those great examples would be in the 70s in West Germany around gay organizing and what to do with some of the more utopian ideas that were coming out of the sexual revolution around intergenerational sex. So what do you do with the question of pedophilia and people who are advocating for absolute sexual freedom, even if that means sexual freedom across the age barrier. And so here's a great example where in West Germany, there was a real, wrestling with, how are we going to secure the rights of, the majority of people if it means perhaps sacrificing some of our movement along the way. And so these are decisions that groups have to make. And it's a great example of good kin and bad kin, that certain people and the way that they want to live their lives don't serve the purposes of the group. And so there are some of these interesting moments where certain people are just seen as not fitting. And I was really interested in sort of thinking through some of these examples, because they really do help us understand the radical potential of politics. And sometimes when we have to make, or we choose to make, decisions for more respectability driven approaches to politics. And sometimes I think that thorny story gets forgotten when we are celebrating all that we've achieved, and we forget that, oh, well, in some cases, some people were sacrificed along the way.
And I guess, as you said, respectability plays a key role in these discussions, and also for your book in general, I would say.
Definitely. I mean, that's where it's a very contemporary, the book ends with a very contemporary discussion about the losses and the gains of what we've achieved. And also it's meant to sort of open the door to alternative pathways that could have been taken. So in this way, it's an interesting work of history, because it's just really trying to make us self-aware that, what does it mean that we hold very dear that we have certain political formations, social formations based around the family and marriage, and that is seen as sort of the pinnacle of what we've worked for. When, if we look through time and history, we see that not all queers, not all gays and lesbians believed that the family was really the outcome of their organizing. They wanted to do away with everything that looked bourgeois and heteronormative. And so why have we lost that sense of our collective past? And what does it mean when we put all of our eggs in the basket of an institution that looks a heck of a lot like heterosexual institutions that we apparently once were very critical of? So my book is trying to kind of get us just to be very self-aware about, where we find ourselves today.
I mean, in that sense, you also push us towards a different queer historiography that does not maybe center itself around identity, but rather finds traces of affect, libidinal investments, erotics, and joy. Could you tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, that's something that is really very much a product of having done a different kind of queer history for a good part of my life. So I started out like many of us, at least historians, trained at a certain moment in the wake of the really excellent work by people like George Chauncey, looking at regulation, early 20th century US in his case, legal reform, some cases sexology, a lot of the work in sexology. And what I found was we tended to tell the same story, and that was of state repression, whether that's through, the law or through medicine, and efforts to just push back at that. And I found that only went so far in explaining the nuts and bolts of people's lives. And I thought that maybe what we needed to do was find a new set of methods, a new set of questions that would force us to ask different questions of the past, and in the process would show us a different story than just repression and resistance, that might actually get us to see other things like desire, love, lust, longing, emotions that go beyond just, these two. And so for me, it was about trying to write a different kind of queer history, which also lent itself to using different methods and also a different source base. So instead of just looking at police files and court records, which is what I always did, and which is a perfectly excellent way to do history, I said to myself, well, why don't we look at photography? Or why don't we look at theater? or why don't we look at the kinds of sources that are more subjective and maybe difficult to work with? Why don't we, as historians, spend time with those sources and develop a framework for pulling them apart in new ways, because they might reveal different stories and different voices than the ones that we're used to? So that's how I ended up getting really interested in both the different method of doing the work, but also a different source base entirely.
And I mean, one of the things I really enjoyed in the book is that you also reflect on these choices, and you make the work of history show itself, which is really, I think, important, but also really enjoyable to read, because usually some texts can be very obscure in the sense that how those things comes together, but then you show how those things actually come together.
It's funny that you say that. I mean, that was one of the things that I pitched to Princeton. I said, you know, this book is not just sort of the omniscient, you know, narrator, you know, just presenting the facts. It would be really about sort of, and it's not a success story, you know, like I made assumptions around the work in moments in time that reflected the era and that reflected the limits of my own thinking and the limits of my own politics. And so I tried to really put that in there to show us that we do evolve as scholars, and that people's work matters, because it didn't just, you know, it wasn't that I woke up one morning and I said, oh, race, I have been really not tackling race. It's because other scholars' work, you know, made me pivot my own position and positionality. And I wanted the reader to see that is not just doable, but that's essential. And so to front end that part of the story was key, and to make it then part of kinship. So I'm reading the past with the help of these other people who have no idea the impact they've made on me, but that their work is pushing me to do my work better. And I wanted that to be very much a part of the story, in a way that didn't then make it the entire story. So it's not just me meandering about, but it's really just showing the importance of being self-reflective and thinking through the choices that we make.
So in a sense, it's also an intellectual history, so to say.
It's not history, right? Like, in a way, it's that's where I always find it funny, because it's that those are the moments where historians don't do that generally. And that's where, you know, but people in sociology, criminology, you know, any of the ethnographic work that people do, it's been common to do this sort of auto-reflective, very common. And yet for historians, it's like, oh, that's strange. And so it's also about really showing the benefits of other ways of doing things for what we, you know, in our own little corner of the field.
And I mean, like, I was gonna already mention this, but like, I mean, I think it even goes beyond that, because you really implicate yourself in the book, but also in the here and now of the researcher in the analysis, without being presentist. And this was especially the case in your analysis of like Wilhelm von Bloden, like the pictures and like the critique, but also like different way of looking at those pictures. From not today's perspective per se, but from your relationship with these pictures, maybe. Can you tell us more about this kind of, I mean, because this implication goes beyond being reflective, right? It's also acknowledging that you as a subject, as a person, you have also, you're part of the queer kinship, basically.
Yeah. And it's also, well, so the example is Wilhelm von Gloden is this Prussian, 19th century Prussian photographer who travels, like so many in the 19th century, to Italy, where he embarks on an opportunity to live the life he's always wanted but can't, let's say, in Prussia, and that is one of imperial imaginings and erotic encounters with younger men and boys. And he takes photos of these encounters or people in his midst, and then they become pornographic sort of postcards. It's erotic photography, not really pornographic. And this circulates within Europe and becomes part of this sort of underground homosexual desire that for warmer climates and cultures that are more supposedly open to, you know, the passions of men and boys. And so this is a really interesting set of sources and very challenging, and it's been interpreted in many different ways over the last 100 or so years. And I'm fascinated by them because they also pose interesting challenges in terms of respectability, right? Like, so what do we do with evidence of grown men desiring younger men, younger boys? And we live in a world today where that is just really not acceptable in all sorts of ways. And we've forgotten that those, you know, that same gaze, that set of, those set of desires were set in opposition to 19th century stultifying 19th century visions of masculinity in the family. And we've also forgotten, and this comes from someone like Rachel Cleaves, this amazing scholar who did this very challenging book on a similar story in the UK, we forget that these younger men and boys had agency themselves, and that they came from families that in some cases made choices around, you know, their sons being involved with these European men because it was a better alternative than working in agriculture or in industry at the time. And so what I'm saying is that these images that to our mind today perhaps just look like coercion and power imbalance are actually so much more when we pull them apart in all sorts of ways. And what's interesting is that I am able to do that in a way that colleagues of mine have not always been able to do based on sort of our own positionality. So it's one thing for me to stand up in a room looking as I do, speaking to a very charged and fraught subject. And it's another thing for a younger male scholar to do the same kind of thing where we live in a moment where there's suspicion around one's intentions, where, you know, the erotics around sort of men and boys looks differently if it's being delivered by a younger queer man versus me. And so just to recognize that all of these dynamics are in play and influence sort of the things that we can argue and see in our sources. And then just one other example is that sometimes I find we're in a place today where we look to examples like this, and yeah, we only see the sort of coercion and power imbalance to make arguments about empire and how wrong the imperial gaze was. But we're not always able to recognize that when we do that work, and it's important work, sometimes it's at the cost of, in this case, the boys and their families who lived their lives in a different way at that moment in time and had choices, made choices, and maybe didn't even see themselves as victims of circumstance. So it's just to say that these kinds of sources are really complicated, and it's important that we come at them from a variety of different perspectives, constantly self-aware of how we are positioned in relation to them.
And I mean, maybe moving from this story of photography, you also problematized the politics of visibility in queer and trans activism. Can you tell us a bit about that as well?
That's tricky, and that's something I'm still trying to work on in this new work that I'm doing around visibility politics and how sometimes the people who become sort of the visible markers of a movement don't always represent the you know, the many different sides of folks involved in you know, involved in the constituents that are represented by the movements themselves. And so this question of visibility and what issues, what people, what subjects become visible and then palatable is really an interesting one around this question of respectability. You know, as an example, I end the book with, you know, a kind of a nasty moment from a few years back around trying to establish a community center you know, in honor of the legacy of Magnus Hirschfeld, as a way of bringing together queer and maybe trans communities, and that's the question mark, right? This was an effort that was supposed to be a space for a critical conversation between academics and everyday people, and it turns out that the organizers didn't imagine a space that would be trans inclusive. And so this was one of those moments where visibility politics, so we've gotten to a place where we could actually have an institution beyond the Schwules Museum that might represent sort of the queer past, but it would be at the expense of including trans people. And so that's another example of, you know, gains and losses, that we've attained a certain amount of respect and rights for certain members of the community, but not always including other members. And trans people would be one example. And then, as we know, the Islamophobia within the queer movements in Germany has been another one of those places where we haven't seen the, you know, the aspirations of equality, you know, really pan out for everyone.
I mean, also having in mind the Homo Monument, how does German memory culture play into all of this?
Yeah, the monument is great. It's a great example of all of these things. Just you know, an effort to. So it's 2011 that the monument, the Homo Monument, is unveiled, and it was a huge deal. It was a huge amount of work to get a monument in the center of Berlin to recognize for Germany to recognize its historical injustices vis-a-vis queer people. And so this was a very big deal, and it's not the first monument that we've seen in Germany. But at the same time, it was the result of a lot of organizing and a lot of effort. And so when this was unveiled, it's also interesting because we have when this is brought into being, you know, we find out about one of these last remaining survivors who shows himself to the committee and says, "This is my story. I was persecuted by the Nazis, and here I am." And then also in the post-war period. So it's this huge, huge moment of reckoning and success for the queer movement. But then, in the way that the monument actually, you know, comes together, it reveals all sorts of fissures and fault lines that had been so far unprocessed. And one of those was, of course, you know, how do we deal with the fact that lesbians were also targeted by the Nazis, but not in the same way that gay men were? And so do we represent them in the monument, or do we not represent them? And so that unleashed a huge debate among some mainstream feminists who, you know, really wanted female inclusion in the monument. And then, you know, there were some of the choices that were made around how to actually put the monument together. So it has this wonderful, for folks that don't know, right, it has this wonderful sort of vitrine that is through which you can see a film. And it originally was intended to have a film with, you know, two young men kissing, and they were meant to represent sort of lost desire and the beauty of queer love living on. And so some folks said, well, it's two men. And some folks said that that's not representative. And then it became unveiled that one of the actors in the film actually had a far right sort of connection. And that was problematic, because what are we representing then if we're representing queer desire? So it just became this sort of focal point for a larger conversation. And then the one other thing that's interesting about it, and it's still there. So while the film has been changed out, and it's meant now to represent the queer community, queer trans community broadly, it still has the placard in front of it that provides the story of the monument. And if you look at it today, you can still read that it says, you know, Germany bears a historic responsibility to take a stance in protecting sort of queer love. But then it's got this interesting phrasing that says, you know, Germany has this special responsibility because it's learned from its past, and the challenge to queer desire, it's inferred, comes from away. And this placard basically says that, you know, homophobia doesn't exist in Germany. We've learned and moved on. but it comes from away. And when it was built also around this moment of, you know, Islamophobia that suggested that migrants brought homophobia with them to Germany. And this was one of those cultural values that we can't get behind, which is a fiction because we know that homophobia remains a problem in Germany. It remains a problem in Canada. And it's not brought to Germany or to Canada, the US, from others, it's homegrown. And so this is one of those interesting ways in which the monument does a lot of different kinds of work and where it still needs to perhaps go further still.
Oh, I mean, as I was reading the chapter, I was shocked that at some point I agreed with Alice Schwarzer about the topic. That was funny to figure out as well. Before we end, I would like to hear also more about your new project. What are you working on now?
I'm trying to write a global sort of history of photography that asks really a very basic question. And that is, if we were to view the sexual revolution, such as it is, if we were to view the sexual revolution through photography, you know, what story would it tell us that is different than if we were to, say, view it through a legal or a medical lens? So how would we write the history of the sexual revolution differently if we wrote it through photos? And that's everything from personal collections of photos, you know, party photos, street photography, photo books. So how would it look differently? And it's really, again, another example of doing a sort of a trans-inclusive queer approach to sexuality through photos from around the world. And so it's meant to be a global story. And the trick is that I'm hoping to write it for a crossover audience. So while this book that I just did is sort of dense and theoretical, this other book is meant to take all of those really great ideas that we read as scholars, but to try to boil them down in a way for everyday readers who are super keen on this story, but, you know, don't want to have to labor through the way that academics speak to each other. So that's, for me, that's the challenge, because I've come to realize that that's my language. That is the academic speak is the language that I've used. And so what does it mean now to actually write in a way that, you know, my kids can understand or my neighbors can, you know, get excited about. And so that's the challenge at hand alongside the global lens, which is not for the faint at heart. It's a great example of, you know, all of the wonderful work that's out there that we really don't always look at because we are so bounded by our sort of national, you know, our national frames. So that's what the next book is going to look like.
It sounds so exciting. I look forward to reading it. And maybe we'll have another conversation about that book when it's out.
That would be great.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jennifer. It was such a pleasure and fun conversation, and I recommend everyone to read this wonderful book.
Thanks so much for having me.